You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of May 2014 here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Tyler Brulé, coming up on today's program.
The fact that Australia, Malaysia and China have got together is testimony of the commitment in what we have promised to the families, especially, that the search will go on.
Those leading the search for missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 say they will not give up. 2 months since the Boeing 777 went missing over the southern Indian Ocean. Gavin McFadden, director of the Centre for Investigative Journalism, and John Everard, the UK's former ambassador to North Korea, will be with me to discuss that and more of the day's news. Also ahead...
These days, the House Republicans actually give John Boehner a harder time than they give me. Which means orange really is the new black.
President Obama garners largely favorable reviews for his performance at the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner in Washington, D.C. We'll ask how tricky it is for a president to be funny. And yes, my friends, it's that time of year again. The Eurovision Song Contest rolls into Copenhagen ahead of Saturday's grand finale. We'll begin our week-long series of special reports on Europe's largest television extravaganza a little later in the program. All that and much more, too, right here in Midori House, here on Monocle 24, starting now. So here we are in Studio One for the next 58 minutes here at Midori House on a bank holiday Monday here in London. I think most people everywhere else around the world, though, are working, including our building. I'm here with World News.
Monocle 24 News. The Islamist kidnapper of more than 200 Nigerian girls missing for 3 weeks says he'll sell them. Abu Bakar Shekau is claiming in a video obtained by the news service AFP that a buyer for the students, who he describes as slaves, will be found. At least 223 schoolgirls were seized by suspected Boko Haram militants during a raid in the village of Chibok in northeast Nigeria on the 14th of April. Hundreds of protesters have taken to the streets in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos, calling on the government to intensify its search for the girls. Nigeria's president, Goodluck Jonathan, who's been under pressure from parents, says he believes the girls are safe.
One good thing that I'm a bit happy, and I believe most Nigerians are happy, is that there's no story that any of them has been hurt in terms of injured or dead.
Hundreds of protesters, as I say, have been on the streets of Lagos. Ayo Yemisi, head of the Serendipity House Mission for Women and Girls in Lagos, also wants confirmation of who the kidnappers are.
What we are here to do is to let the government know that they should declare the identity of the kidnappers and release our daughters. This is not too much an assignment for Nigeria to do, and that is why we are here.
A Ukrainian helicopter has been shot down over the pro-Russian stronghold of Slovyansk as violence in the country continues to worsen. Defense Ministry officials say the pilot survived. The helicopter, an Mi-24, came under heavy machine gun fire and crashed into a river. Officials say the crew were evacuated to a nearby camp, but they've given no details of their condition. Elsewhere in the east of the country, 4 paramilitary policemen have been shot dead in fighting. Russia has called on the Kiev government to stop using armed force against its people and enter talks aimed at resolving the crisis in Ukraine. The World Health Organization says the spread of polio to countries previously considered free of the crippling disease is a global health emergency. The virus was once driven to the brink of extinction, but it's recently made a comeback. The WHO says outbreaks in Asia, Africa and the Middle East need a coordinated international response. The agency is recommending citizens of affected countries travelling abroad carry vaccination certificates. Afghanistan has been mourning the victims of the devastating landslide that killed scores of people in a remote northeastern province last week. Sunday was declared a national day of mourning for victims of the disaster. TV and radio stations suspended the entertainment programmes out of respect to the victims. President Hamid Karzai expressed his deep sadness by the loss of life and property caused by the landslide. He also promised that a high-ranking government delegation would travel to the affected area. The UN's humanitarian coordinator in Afghanistan, Mark Bowden, has arrived in the village of Barak Shan to see for himself the extent of the devastation.
This is the year where we've seen the most deaths from natural disasters for a decade in Afghanistan. Over 150 people have died as a result of floods, in addition to the people who have died here, and we have at least 68,000 people displaced. And I think our focus really has to be, in the months ahead, on how we make sure those people who've lost everything, lost their homes, are able to get back to a more normal life.
Government officials from Australia, China and Malaysia have been meeting in Australia's capital, Canberra, to discuss the next stage in the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines aircraft. They've pledged to continue the search for the Boeing 777 that disappeared more than 2 months ago. No trace of flight MH370 has been found since it vanished on a scheduled service from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing on March the 8th, despite an intensive search. Well, more on that story in a few minutes' time here in Midori House. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Bill. More from you in about 23 and a half minutes. You are indeed listening to Midori House here in London. We're back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is just 2:07. If you're listening in Tokyo, it's and it's 13:07. New York, it's 18:07 here in London. Well, joining me now with her take on the news and many other things, hopefully, is Gavin McFadden and John Everard. Gentlemen, very good to see you as ever. I wanted to kick off the program, though. It's been 2 months since Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. John, you and I were chatting about this a couple of weeks ago. Of course, the aircraft leaves Kuala Lumpur en route to Beijing. It vanishes somewhere over the southern Indian Ocean. And then, you know, every breakthrough that we've heard about along the way leads to a bit of a dead end. And then, of course, today in Canberra, there's been this meeting, representatives, of course, of the governments involved who've been leading the search efforts aim to really sort of script something of a plot forward. This is Hisham Mudin Hussein, Malaysia's acting transport minister, who is in Canberra for the talks. This is what he had to say a bit earlier.
The fact that Australia, Malaysia and China have got together with a very strong delegation from the three nations to discuss and chart the way forward is testimony of the commitment in what we have promised to the families, especially, that the search will go on.
Hisham Mudin Hussein, Malaysia's acting transport minister, there speaking a little while ago. When asked about the cost of the continuing search, Australia's deputy prime minister, Warren Truss, who's chairing the meeting, this is what he had to say.
The estimate of $60 million cost is Australia's estimate of what we think this next phase will cost. And we will need to discuss with Malaysia and with China and with other parties who have an interest in this how that or whatever other costs there might be shared.
Well, gentlemen, a busy day in Canberra, and it was quite something listening to all of this. And I couldn't help but sort of course, go back to Air France Flight 447. Many people at the time were saying that it actually rather suited France Incorporated, Airbus, Air France, that they could be, you know, dragging all kinds of sonar across the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean at that time. There were so many vested interests involved that conspiracy theorists and others were saying, yes, you know, indeed, it suited France down to a T. Do you think this is a slightly different situation here? John, we'll start with you.
Well, it's different in some ways, similar in others. Sure, there are lots of conspiracy theories. I think it's well known that my personal favorite is that Kim Jong-un's brother was on board, and the whole thing was a North Korean operation. I mean, they disposed of everything in the middle of the ocean. Different, though, in the sense that I think there has been a very, very determined attempt to find this aircraft. Whether now, with money running out, despite the Australians' brave words, they're actually going to make any progress, I think there has to be some doubt.
Gavin.
I sort of share that view. But I think the trouble is that for all of us here, we have very little notion about the complexities of it, particularly in terms of the what I was told somewhere, that that part of the ocean has no meaningful mapping, that there's it's very deep and there's almost no way in a trench 2 miles across and 4 miles deep that you can meaningfully collect sonar signals at all anyway. So one wonders what the science is here. There's a second conspiracy one, too. That's sort of a conspiracy area, I agree. But I think the second one is, did the Americans have a satellite recognition system for ships at sea, which they do, they claim to have, in the Atlantic and the Pacific? I don't know about this particular bit of water. But that would explain nothing unless we know what it's about.
Do you think, John, at some point, and going to Gavin's point there, that someone, of course, rides to the front of the pack, and whether it is the U.S. and everyone has said, so many militaries. Okay, maybe this is not the most policed or watched part of the world, but you hear time and again, someone must know, and then at that point, does someone use it to have the upper hand diplomatically from a global recognition point of view, or it's a big no?
I think that, yes, it's inevitable in these situations that people believe that somebody must know. I frankly doubt that anybody does know. I don't think anybody is withholding information here. I suspect that, quite simply, everybody is completely baffled. Mm. I think what really sets the United States out, though, from other parties involved in the search, is that only the United States has got the Bluefin, the amazing submarine robot that has done such stunning work so far. And they've said that, it's their robot. It wasn't actually built.
And they don't let anyone forget that, because it seems that every time you watch a news bulletin, here you get an Australian name-checked ship, and it's always known that the Bluefin belongs to the United States.
I'm so glad you pointed that out. Exactly. It's the United States who's providing the hardware that makes this search possible. Mm. And they've said that much as they love the search, of course they want to find the aircraft, they can't let their robot go on doing this indefinitely, another 4 weeks maybe. Mm. Now, this brings politics in because, of course, the majority shareholder in this disaster, if that's the right phrase, is China. And China has nothing like a Bluefin robot. So there's going to be massive loss of face and massive scurrying around as the Chinese try to disguise this rather obvious fact. Mm.
What has this done for brand Malaysia? Because they've completely, it's out of their hands. We can run a clip from the acting transport minister, but right now here is this investigation. Of course, it is off the coast of Australia, hopefully, but it's being chaired in Canberra, completely out of Kuala Lumpur's hands, and potentially a good thing.
I think it's probably a good thing for the investigation for it to be there. But I think the initial confusion about the statements being made about where the location of the aircraft was, what efforts were being made to rescue it and all the rest of it, induced a degree of cynicism, I think, in people who were knowledgeable about the area, that they were the least capable of conducting the kind of serious in-depth search that was required. So I don't think it did them any good at all. I think quite the opposite. I think it was even everybody I know would think twice about boarding one of those planes, I think, rightly or wrongly. Mm.
I agree with that. But I think there's another point here, that the single biggest factor that damaged brand Malaysia wasn't what the Malaysians did, or rather didn't do. It was the fact that you had the families of the victims all together in one place, sitting in a hotel, all getting more and more angry. If you put distressed people together, hysteria breeds very, very quickly. And after the first day, nothing the Malaysians could have done was ever going to satisfy those families. Mm-hmm. Their reputation was doomed from the outset.
Yeah. Gavin, this hasn't been journalism's finest hour, certainly on the rolling news services, and I'm glad that we're not sort of doing updates every minute here. But and I'm referencing, I think we all know the networks that we're talking about in the early days, but I guess also that's sort of part of the trade. Does journalism have a role though in this investigation? If there are conspiracy theories, do you think we're going to see perhaps one of the privately funded documentary organizations start to wade in? And is that where maybe part of the story also comes out?
That's a good question. But I think the difficulty for journalism is this is a highly scientific subject with expertise in a very narrowly held hand. So the ability of journalists to get it means that they're dependent on government sources, scientific sources. And that puts you in a very difficult place unless you have inside information. So the Ahmadiyar operations, for example, would rely entirely on that sort of information. And we don't have any of that, as far as I know, so far. There's certainly nothing coming from them about that. So I think we're as ignorant now as we were before. But I think journalism can only play a role when there's independent information. And we don't have that.
We're going to move north from Canberra, head a little further up in Asia. We're going to pass your old stomping grounds, though, John. We're going to go past North Korea. We're going to head to Japan. Of course, it's a Golden Week, and today is a Children's Day today in Japan. No, listeners, that was not the morning anthem here at Midori House, but Japanese school children belting out a tune in the gymnasium. You know, so much, and we've read this report again and again about aging societies. It's the 33rd year running that the birth rate has dropped in Japan. The only sort of two places where there's been a spike is Tokyo and in Okinawa. I guess the first thing, John, are fewer births such a bad thing for a country these days?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the economics depends entirely on how many of the older generation are still in the workforce. And I see that the way that the UN sets the figures out is it sets the young people under 15 against those who are over 65. There's no reason at all why healthy over 65-year-olds should not continue to work and to contribute. If there are fewer children, of course, this means over time that the population will go down. Japan is stuffed with 127 million people. I mean, it's one of the most crowded places on earth. Is it really such a bad thing that that's thin out a bit? I wonder.
Yeah, Kevin, your view on, I guess, you know, on one side, I think the way the sort of the media always portrays this is that, you know, this it can only be a negative. But, you know, you think at the same time, if Japan manages to sort this out, and it's not just going to be Hitachi and Honda robots and all of those things. But, you know, Japan in many ways is already quite good about, you know, being able to market its expertise on a graying society, etc. So, you know, could this also be a benefit for the place, too?
I think so, too. But most countries in which are worried about this problem have large and expansive militaries. Japan, of course, does not. And that means there's not a, to put it cynically, a sort of endless dripping death feed across the population, which would extract out of that population a lot of young men. And I think there's it's a bizarre story. And I would agree with you that this is, in fact, a progressive development in a way, because it means that there'll probably be better employment for those who are there. And there won't be the waste and staggering incompetence that you get with endless cycles of immigrant labor coming into a country because they're cheaper.
John, you probably would agree that Japan is on a small spending spree at the moment. They've got these helicopter carriers that they're putting out to sea, which, of course, are aircraft carriers. If you asked any of those children, that's what they would certainly say they are. How are they going to be able to certainly man these fleets?
Well, I think they'll manage it. I don't think that the numbers of crew required to crew the helicopter carriers is going to be so enormous that it's going to, you know, dent their demographic. But the thing that really drains young men in particular from the labor force is infantry. And there's no talk yet of the Japanese beefing up their capacity in that area.
And one story that we also picked up, which is slightly related to this, and it's out of the Nikkei Asian Review, and it talks about there was a problem last week that Peach Airlines, which is one of these low-cost carriers, the low-cost carriers having a quite difficult time, not just to compete against the likes of JAL and ANA, but also, you know, the Japanese are, of course, you know, incredibly risk-averse. They like solid brands. And here we have a poor Argentinian pilot who flies below the glide slope, and all kinds of alarm bells are going off. But then what it reveals is a much bigger issue, though, that there is this manpower shortage. Oftentimes, you would have seen pilots coming out of the Japanese self-defense forces and, of course, going into airlines or having to bring, you know, foreign pilots in. Is this, Gavin, from your point of view, also just starting to, you know, reveal some of the cracks that they're going to be confronting on a bigger level, you know, next decade?
I think that's right. I think that's certainly true. I'd be surprised, however, that with all the countless small aviation academies throughout Florida, Arizona, New Mexico, which trained some rather unpleasant people a few years ago, I would think that they would provide a wonderful training opportunity and an inexpensive one to solve that as a short-term problem. But there's nothing that they get in this kind of technical area that they can't solve with money. The question is whether they want to pay the money or not.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you put your finger on it there, Gavin. I understand that when JAL went bankrupt a little while ago, a lot of Japanese pilots went and took employment with other airlines. I mean, if you have a problem finding pilots, why don't you go to these pilots who've left Japanese-speaking but have left JAL, and make them an offer they can't refuse, bring them back in.
Exactly.
A lot just comes down to money, that's right.
And we'll probably see that happen before, I would imagine, that any of the Japanese ministries, justice and otherwise, who are responsible for throwing open the doors, certainly to mass migration, before that will happen, John?
Well, actually, migrating into Japan is a lot less difficult than people imagine. The problem is speaking sufficiently good Japanese to interact, especially in sensitive area like a cockpit of an airliner.
Or if you're a Filipino nurse.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's right.
Yes. Which is always amazing when I speak to people in our bureau. I mean, they say it is extraordinary the levels of exams that people have to go through, and probably even people flying in cockpits probably couldn't even pass these English classes.
Well, I suspect that's right.
English being the lingua franca and all. Yes. We're going to go away for a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tyler Burley, Gavin McFadden, and John Everard. When we come back, we're going to be talking about newspapers with a cause and, of course, presidents and their press corps speeches. Stay with us.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24, here in Studio One with me, Tyler Burley, Gavin McFadden and John Everard. Now, come September the 18th, the world may have its newest nation as Scotland heads to the polls to vote on whether to loosen its ties with the United Kingdom. Well, on Sunday, the Glasgow Herald, one of Scotland's major papers, threw its support behind the Yes campaign, becoming the first publication to show its allegiance to, of course, the independence debate. So how influential are endorsements by newspapers in shaping the public debate as newspapers, of course, continue to shift their methods of engaging readers? Gavin, is this just a ploy to, maybe put a 2%, 3.2% spike in newspaper sales, so at least
probably. I think you're right. That makes every sense. I think the difficulty with those pronouncements so often is that the newspaper reflects their readership, and they're not going to do anything that would alienate their readers. I mean, it works both ways, and so that way is a very powerful message. So, for example, if they're saying that they're supporting independence, so are their readers, and they're just confirming what their readers already say. This is different than a middle-class publication in a big urban city, which might sway some people in the middle, but I don't think you're talking about a lot of people being swayed in Scotland.
In this country, John, do you think that it is a case that it's the newspaper, it's television, could be radio? I mean, a lot of people sort of talk about sort of the power of the likes of LBC, et cetera, right now in this country.
Or
even us. Of course, and then you have a lot of people in newsrooms who are, of course, completely on the social media bus and say everything's going to be swayed by, of course, what people are saying on those channels. What do you think it is?
I think electronic media are becoming ever more important. I think if we're looking at the influence that newspapers have, there are three factors here. One is circulation. Second is content, third is timing. The Herald, circulation is a bit over 20,000. It's not exactly a mass medium. Content, I've read its declaration in support of the Yes campaign twice. I've yet to see that it actually says anything. It appears to be a completely content-free declaration. Timing, we're 19 weeks away from this referendum. Mm-hmm. By the time it comes around, everybody will have forgotten what the Herald said.
Mm. I mean,
I agree with that. I think it's entirely right. I think, however, that's very small market is a sort of center-left market and has a considerable bit of clout, at least in the intellectual classes in Scotland. I don't think it has much else than that. It's certainly not going to bring people to the polls in large numbers. Mm. So I think, as you say, 19 weeks to the election, that's a long time in politics, a long, long time.
And are we waiting then for next weekend to someone else then weigh in on the other side? Does that have to happen, of course, then to, keep newspaper sales buoyant?
I doubt it. I mean, I suspect, as Gavin's just hinted, that there is that the lot of the reason they've done this was to push sales up. And I gather that it's worked, that they've sold out of the edition with the famous editorial in. Are other newspapers going to follow suit? If other newspapers are desperate for a spike in sales, I suppose it's possible. But the normal time for a newspaper to declare its hand in a thing like this referendum would be just a short time before the referendum, when all the arguments have been aired. And you get a chance to have one great blockbuster editorial saying yes or no and setting out why, setting people thinking about the way they're going to vote. So I'm not expecting any mass declarations either way until much later in the game.
Gavin, do you think this is going to be good if the yes vote goes ahead and we see an independent Scotland? Will this be good for the state of journalism? Because you might see a situation like in Canada where the Canadian government writes all kinds of checks of support for all kinds of media outlets, certainly a lot of print outlets, documentary making in Canada, etc., quite heavily government funded. Mm-hmm. Does that mean then Scotland's going to have to make its voice in the world and suddenly we're going to see all kinds of subsidies, or will there be that kind of money when you're trying to forge your way in the world and plant your flag everywhere?
I think that Scotland is a much more political place than Canada, and with a much more ingrained tradition, left and right both. So I expect that it'll be quite vital. In Canada, there's huge areas where there's no politics at all. And if there is, they're almost comic. So it's not a serious thing, I think, whereas Scotland, in fact, is very serious. I think the issue that would concern me is whether information will come late in the day about the oil reserves are much less than they thought, or that the banking crisis may affect them in the housing market in a very strong way. I would expect something like that.
So we may not see necessarily three new dailies or two new global news channels popping up out of Edinburgh just yet. Gavin McFadden, John Oliver, just before we go, we should jump from Edinburgh over to Washington, D.C., and hear a little something from the last week's White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Just yesterday, I read a heartbreaking letter. I get letters from folks around the country every day. I get 10 that I read. This one got to me. A Virginia man who's been stuck in the same part-time job for years, no respect from his boss, no chance to get ahead. I really wish Eric Cantor would stop writing me.
President Obama there at the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner. John, so often when people are short of an idea, at least on this side of the Atlantic and maybe in this city, we always try to, of course, adopt something out of Washington, and whether we talk about having, potentially our own homeland security operations and adopting all of the language out of Washington. Do you think we're about to see a number 10 Downing Street Correspondents' Dinner, with corporate sponsorship and all the types of things that we see in the US popping up anytime soon?
And with David Cameron making that kind of jokes, I would love it. But realistically, I don't think you and I are going to see it anytime soon. Mm. It's such a pity. I mean, a lot of the jokes the President Obama cracked were actually very funny and very direct. I just wish we had that over here.
Mm. Does that say something about a different type of press corps? Not just, here, but pretty much everywhere else in the world. And certainly when you look at sort of the power and I guess the star value that also domestic correspondents still have in the U.S.
They do. And I think it's also true that I was wondering, listening to that, who was the writer? Because it certainly wouldn't have been President Obama, who's not famous for a certainly delicious sense of humor. Mm. I think that, like everything else, it's professionalized in the States. And there would be ad agencies and PR companies producing comic writers for the presidency. The only thing they'd have to sign is a non-disclosure agreement. I think other than that, it would be pretty much normal. I think that, as you say, I think it would be very unlikely to see it here. I think anything like that.
If we did, I just want to say I've been involved in writing speeches for all kinds of people on many occasions. And I remember one distinct occasion, I'm not going to name names now, where for quite a senior politician, we had to write a speech and he said, this has to be funny. So what we did, we got all our speech us together and we got all the crack jokes we think of, all the jokes we've been desperate to work into speeches for months beforehand, got several bottles of good strong wine out and concocted this complete tirade against all political opponents. And he delivered it, bless him. But yeah, all done by the speechwriter, but hey, it was fun.
Gavin McFadden, director for the Center for Investigative Journalism, and John Everard, the United Kingdom's former ambassador to North Korea and a very frequent visitor to Midori House. Gentlemen, thanks for popping in on a bank holiday Monday. Very good to see you.
Pleasure.
We're back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, eu sou London. This is Monaco 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monaco 24.
Para London, dette Monaco 24.
From London.
This is Londres.
Holanda.
London.
London으로부터.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
Plenty still to come in the next half hour on today's Midori House. We'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world, review the latest visual arts exhibitions in Belgrade, and before the end of the program... we'll throw ourselves into this year's Eurovision Song Contest in Copenhagen. Before we get started on all of that, Mr. Bill Bingham is back with World News headlines.
And the Islamist kidnapper of more than 200 Nigerian girls missing for 3 weeks says he'll sell them. Hundreds of protesters have taken to the streets in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos, calling on the government to intensify its search for the girls. Ukrainian helicopter has been shot down over the pro-Russian stronghold of Slovyansk as violence in the country continues to worsen. Defence Ministry officials say the pilot survived. The helicopter, an Mi-24, came under heavy machine gun fire and crashed into a river. An Ohio Veteran Affairs Medical Centre has been put on lockdown following reports of an active shooter on the Dayton campus. Local media reports say police are on the scene and searching for a possible suspect. Reports say at least one person has been injured. The World Health Organization says the spread of polio to countries previously considered free of the crippling disease is a global health emergency. The agency is recommending citizens of affected countries travelling abroad to carry vaccination certificates. Government officials from Australia, China and Malaysia have been meeting in the capital, Canberra, to discuss the next stage in the search for the missing Malaysian Airlines aircraft. They've pledged to continue the search for the Boeing 777 that disappeared more than 2 months ago. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Bill. You're listening to Midori House. It's just gone to 2:31, actually coming up to 2:32, if you're listening in Osaka, 20:32 in Helsinki. It is 18:32 in London, and it's 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now, though, to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we're going to head to Italy and our correspondent, Mr. Ivan Carvalho, who joins me now on the line. Hello, Ivan.
Good evening, Tyler.
All well with you?
Yes, indeed.
Very good. Where do we want to start? Do we want to head to Rome, I guess, via Florence, and of course talk about Mr. Renzi? Should we start on that note?
Yeah, Mr. Dynamo. I mean, Matteo Renzi has been known for his energy in trying to push reforms through on all fronts, from electoral law reform to labor market reform. He's finally hit some roadblocks, though, because there's this reform of the Senate which he wants to sort of take apart the upper house and make it into a sort of a consultatory body and not a major legislative making body. But he's running into some problems within his own party, the PD, and with opposition. So it looks like he's going to miss one of his deadlines, because he's been setting deadlines from when he first came into office, and he's going to miss this one deadline to get the bill through before the European elections, which is seen as key now because Beppe Grillo's five-star movement is sort of trying to rally the troops to push through to hopefully they believe make some gains against Renzi at the end of this month when the people go to vote for the EU elections.
Mm. Now, Ivan, anyone who pays any attention to the aviation pages of certainly any of the trade titles will know that Etihad Airlines out of Abu Dhabi has been circling Alitalia for some time. Very keen, of course, to at least have a little more sway over that airline. Now, you know, an outright takeover is probably something very different, just given, of course, ownership laws that still exist within the EU. But nevertheless, of course, Abu Dhabi is very interested in looking at investing in the airline. But of course, there are, you know, a series of other problems that go along with it. Of course, major job cuts being one of them. I guess two things. Do you see Rome weighing in on this one? But I also wonder how emotional a discussion is this in Italy? I mean, everyone, you know, certainly, you know, outside of Italy, everyone sort of, you know, takes every opportunity to slag off the carrier. I know lots of Italians do as well. But would there be a lot of tears if the airline disappeared or suddenly it was seen to be controlled by certainly the oil money out of the Gulf?
I think in today's world, citizens aren't as, let's say, romantically tied to their flag carrier, because you know Alitalia got a government rescue package last year that was about half a billion euros, and the government now, the infrastructure minister is saying that there is no bailout coming. So this courtship with Etihad, and it's been a long one. There's been due diligence by the Abu Dhabi carrier for a long time, and they've been a bit cautious about approaching Alitalia because it's laden with debt. They want job cuts. And you know they're offering up to 49% because you mentioned, of course, those ownership laws in the EU. So they would go after 49% and they would put up to half a billion themselves. But they've been very cautious about what Alitalia needs to do in terms of they have to cut up to 3,000 jobs, and that's going to be difficult for the government of Renzi to stomach. But you know the public, I don't think they're as willing now with the economy, the state of the Italian economy, to have to see their tax dollars go again to save an airline which hasn't had a strategy for many years to cope with. I mean, it's the fourth largest air travel market in Europe, and they haven't gotten their game together. Of course, you know, high-speed rail has hurt the domestic links. You know, the Milan-Rome shuttle is now operated by a private and public rail operator, and Alitalia needs to find another strategy, medium haul. And it's difficult when you have carriers like these oil-rich carriers, whether it's Emirates, who are flying three times now and on to New York from Milan through Dubai. I mean, it's through Milan from Dubai. It's difficult, and it's going to be, if this sort of saving grace doesn't come through now, I'm not sure what's going to happen. We may see Alitalia fold. It's quite serious for the Rome-based carrier.
Let's move on to transport of another kind, also very much up and down. And this is a story which comes from the shores, or just beyond the canal, certainly, of Venice.
Yeah, this is an interesting project. Of course, you know, Venice, people always say, you know, it's the Disneyland for tourists, but now a company based near Venice that is known for making roller coaster rides from Coney Island to Euro Disney, even to North Korea, this company, Zamperla, has a concession to operate. They want to operate a small amusement park on a disused piece of land that used to be a garbage incinerator. Now it's just vacant land, and they want to put up an amusement park. And there's been, of course, the resistance always from environmental groups and also the heritage, you know, groups that want to preserve Venice. But then there's the governor of the Veneto saying, you know, this could be good for jobs. The mayor is still kind of cautious about the project. You know, they wanted to have a London sort of eye, you know, wheel, and that's been shot down. So it's going to be curious to see how this plays out, because it's you know, 500 jobs could be created. You know, it's an $80 million investment. So again, you know, Venice's future is always this sort of ping pong, but back and forth between, you know, preserving it, but then trying to keep it alive with tourism, and how best to do that.
And finally, just before we go, a similar story in many ways. World's Fair pulls into Milan exactly a year from now. How is this being met? Because, you know, I have to say it's very few cities that manage to get it right and create a proper legacy. Now, you can see, you know, a variety of different projects that are going up in and around the city. But I still don't get the sense, you know, unless you're listening to this program or maybe, you know, spending even any, you know, serious time in Milan, that people even know that this World's Fair is coming.
Yeah, it's gone through a couple of different modifications, and now we're looking at this thing that's much more reduced than what was the big ambitious project before. You're now seeing the pavilions being rolled up by various countries. It's all based around this theme of farming and feeding the planet is the theme, and so you're seeing lots of these very mix of high tech and old school sort of agriculture together. I mean, like the U.S. is pulling out this pavilion with hydroponic farming and this vertical wall of crops, and the Swiss are going sort of a bit traditional with, you know, gabled roofs and a bit of machinery, a bit of high tech as well. But yeah, again, the World's Fair in Milan, yeah, as you mentioned, you know, the promotion of it hasn't been. I think that there needs to be more, because a lot of people don't, even in Italy, don't know how long it's going on for. There was a recent poll about, you know, when exactly is it going to be next year? How long is it going to be? And so the numbers that they're expecting over 20 million, a lot of locals, critics, the newspapers, and others are saying that, you know, these figures are quite optimistic. So we'll have to see what kind of promotional campaigns that the mayor's office does in the next, let's say, 6 months.
Ivan Carvalho, our man in Milan. We're going to make sure that we get you your own special roving studio this time next year. Very good hearing from you. Up next, we're going to leaf through the pages of one of the most famous diaries in the Catalan language, which has just been published in English for the first time. Stay with us.
On the Foreign Desk this week, we look back 40 years to Portugal's Carnation Revolution.
When my wife told me that there'd been a coup in Portugal, my question was in favor or against.
Four decades since dictatorship gave way to democracy, we'll ask what the revolution means to the country today.
I think it's important to realise how dramatically impoverished the dictatorship had left Portugal and how, relatively speaking, the quality of life changed dramatically.
And as Portugal continues to grapple with its economic crisis, how bright is the country's future?
Europe is in a very difficult position, and we should also change not only Portugal, because we can't change only Portugal. We must change Europe too.
That's Revolution Portugal, this week's edition of The Foreign Desk on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé. It's just gone 1941, pardon me, if you're listening in Copenhagen. It's 1341 in Washington, D.C. Now, in 1918, an aspiring Catalan writer searching for a job in journalism began a diary. "I'll write whatever happens simply to pass the time, come what may," he wrote in the journal's opening entry. And for the next 20 months, Josep Pla wrote every day, wrote every day of life in Catalonia, and in doing so, he became one of the most celebrated writers in the history of the Catalan language. Well, the diaries, published in English for the first time, have just been released. I'm delighted to say that Peter Bush, the translator of Josep Pla's The Grey Notebook, joins me live now. Hello.
Hi.
I guess the first point, a very interesting time, of course, for Catalonia politically and where it's going to sit, certainly on a European stage, but also internationally. Does this partly also play into this as well? Is there some significance that the book now comes out in English at this time?
I think that there is more interest with publishers in literature from Catalan in Catalan because of the political situation. That's for sure. Yeah.
And in terms of what also, I guess, pushed it into English at this time, was it really, you know, the passion of a certain publishing group? How did we get to the stage where we are right now?
Well, I think it's coming out with the New York Review of Books, which have a fantastic list of classics. And Edwin Frank, the editor there, has been to Barcelona. He's kind of met with writers here and translators, and he wanted to bring into Catalan this diary which he'd heard so much about.
I want to just play a very short clip, which just really illustrates at least one part of The Grey Notebook. Let's have a listen.
Sunday, November the 3rd, 1918. A night at the cinema. Frou-frou with Francesca Bertini, Gustav Serena, and the usual Italian suspects. A very ordinary plot, played by people who spend hours and hours posing for their portraits, who would like to pose night and day indefinitely. Bewildering, enthusiastic cries of admiration go up from the audience when a luxurious set or an elegant dress puts in an appearance. As we leave the cinema, Roldos plays a Schumann score for Coromina, Luis Medir, and me. Schumann never got a note wrong. He is as round as an apple, or an almond, though slightly sweet, with a circumference that's ever so slightly too perfect. Schumann seems two-dimensional, Chopin three.
And just a little reading there from Josep Pla's The Grey Notebook. I wanted to go back to this type of reportage, and I guess, you know, working, of course, you know, on this and hearing the release. For people who aren't familiar with his work, who would you say, you know, a contemporary might have been, certainly in the U.S. press, in the U.K. press?
He covered the Treaty of Versailles. He was there when the Mussolini's march on on Rome, and he went to Russia in 1925 and wrote a series of articles on the state of the revolution at the time of when the new economic policy was being forced through, and this became a best-selling book in Barcelona in 1925. I mean, I think more of him in terms of somebody like Joseph Roth, in terms of kind of how he's situated in European literature. He was a man who liked to think of himself as on the edges, on the margins. He didn't really fit in with the Catalan literary establishment. He hated the university in Barcelona. He thought it was pedantic and it had nothing to do with real learning. And he found a home with intellectuals at the Athenaeum, some of them at least, and a whole kind of host of ordinary people, of fishermen, barmen. You know, the Grey Notebook is full of hundreds of characters that he was friends with, and they have these vignettes like the one with the piece of music from the cinema. Well, that he goes for walks with the pianist along the coast on the Costa Brava, and then he's very sad when the pianist is very poor and eventually dies by the time that Pla had gone to Barcelona after the flu epidemic had finished, which had shut down the university.
Mm. If you are a rising journalist today at an academy in Catalonia, is this is Pla sort of a name still at this point that a 21st century potential journalism graduate would look up to? The narrative, the style of reportage is something which is still revered in academic halls?
Oh yeah, I mean he was a leading journalist. I mean he's like, you know, an Orwell, if you like, the Catalan Orwell. His books, many of his books of essays about the rise of the Republic, the Second Republic, are still in print. The actual translation of the Grey Notebook has received a lot of attention in the Catalan newspapers.
And the fact that it's going into English, that particular component?
Sorry?
The fact that it's going into English has received a lot of play in the Catalan press.
That's right, yes, because it's the first book by Pla to go into English. I mean, there are other Catalan writers like Mercè Rodoreda and her in Diamond Square that has been translated three times, but this is the first book by Pla, and he's a major European writer. And I'm now working on a book of short stories by him called The Bitter Life, or The Bitterness of Life, La Vida Amarga, which he wrote when he was a European correspondent in the 1920s, like 25 stories based on his experiences in Berlin, in Portugal, in London, in Leeds. You know, there's a story about an Irishman in the suburb of Meanwood in Leeds. I mean, he's quite uncharacteristic of Spanish writers at the time, in that he has, you know, this kind of European perspective, which you really see in the short stories, but you also see in the diary through his reading. You know, he's kind of inspired by Montaigne. He tells you about how, you know, his responses to reading Proust. He kind of quotes from Nietzsche, and this when he was, you know, 19 or 20.
Mm. Peter Bush, translator of Joseph Pla's The Grey Notebook. And of course, this is coming out as part of the classic series from the New York Review of Books. You're listening to Midori House here in London. We're back in a moment. And we are live on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brulé, certainly sitting at the head of the table. Ladies and gentlemen, most of you around the world, you might recognize this little theme. Indeed, it is Eurovision in less than a week, in fact. And as you might well expect, Monocle 24 will be there every step of the way in the build-up to the grand finale, of course, of the Eurovision Song Contest in Copenhagen on Saturday night. Well, our resident Eurovision editor, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, will be in the Danish capital later this week to give us, of course, the taste of the joys to come. And I'm delighted to say he's with me in studio before he packs off, of course, to Kastrup Airport. Welcome. Very good to
see
you.
Can't wait. Very good to see you as well.
Tell me your research going into this. What are your sort of bets so far?
Well, actually, this year is a very easy one. I think Armenia is going to win. And it's interesting because they're quite new for Eurovision. Their first entry was 2006. And the song this year is this guy, his name's Aran MP3, and the song's Not Alone. And it's quite a powerful ballad, Tyler. But you know, the funny thing is, after you listen for 2 minutes, suddenly the song becomes kind of, there's some electronic music, some dubstep. It's quite an interesting entry, and I think it's the favorite. Of course, you have Sweden is the second favorite.
Right.
I mean, it's a nice ballad by Sanna Nielsen called Undo.
We have to, of course, remember that, of course, this is happening in Copenhagen. So it's home team. But as we know, you know, as much as the Nordic nations like to accuse, you know, certainly of all of the new nations in Eastern Europe for voting for each other, one would say that the Nordic nations invented voting for their neighbors.
I mean, they all vote for each other. And to be honest, I kind of want Armenia to win. I don't want to go back to Sweden next year. I was there last year in Malmo, you know. Let's add some spice to the mix.
So you're hoping for a ticket to Yerevan. Well, this is interesting to hear. Tell me as well, when you look at that lineup, are there potentially sort of, you know, anyone sort of lingering? You know, there's always, you know, we have seen surprises. It's been known to happen. Well, you know, there is, and you know, and of course, you know, Armenia has friends and otherwise. So do you, any sort of outside chances on any of us?
Well, why not bet on Austria? You know, they have one of the most interesting acts this year, the Austrian drag queen Conchita Wurst with the song Rising Like a Phoenix. I was just talking here with our sound engineer, also a Eurovision fan. It sounds like a James Bond song, you know, like the theme song, you know. So I do think it's going to win. Mm. It could be a potential winner. I mean, maybe it's not going to beat Armenia, but you know. If you want to change your bets a little bit more.
Now, just tell me, what happens, I mean, aside from sort of, you know, a jolly and sort of drinking lots of Carlsberg's finest, when you get up to Copenhagen, what is your research going to involve? I'm not going to tell your editor.
Yeah. Well, and of course, there's a lot of journalists there as well. And for example, later this evening, we're going to talk with the Wall Street Journal Eurovision correspondent, and we're going to talk as well about
the Wall Street Journal really has a Eurovision correspondent?
Oh, they do. Right, actually, okay. I'm going to have coffee with her as soon as I arrive there on Thursday.
Right.
And she's going to talk about, because you know the issue about Crimea, right, Tyler? Mm-hmm. It's quite an interesting issue because, you know, Crimea now belongs to Russia, but actually the people who vote in Crimea, actually the vote's going to count as Ukraine. So it's causing quite a lot of controversy. And in recent years as well, Ukraine and Russia, they used to support each other, but in recent years, that's not been the case.
Well, I think one other way to sort of shake things up, I would like to see maybe every year we should invite sort of five other nations. Of course, we'd extend a welcome to Brazil for sure.
They have Israel.
Well, listen, and I thought that we could maybe, I would also invite Korea. Of course, I'd invite our friends from Japan in as well. This is actually one winter play who I like very, very much. This is their song called Shake It Up and Down. Fernando, great to hear from you. When I've had bad days or good days, shake it up and down, oh shake it up and down, oh shake it up and down, oh 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 shake. From the streets of Gangnam there, that is Winter Play from Seoul with the song, if you didn't catch it, Shake It Up and Down. We're going to, of course, jump to the other side of Europe right now, though. Our Guy Delaney is in Belgrade to talk things all arts-related as we hurtle towards the end of the show. Hello, Guy.
Hello, Sala. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Should we talk about museums of contemporary art that are kind of reopening, or should we talk about invisible violence? Where do you want to start?
It's all sort of linked in, really. I mean, the Museum of Contemporary Art, if people don't know this, is a very sorry tale. It should be a terrific museum in Belgrade, but it's been closed for about 7 years now for a renovation project, which has just gone on and on and on. And it's left some of the country's best artworks under wraps. I've seen the storage facilities. They're in quite pretty wraps, but nonetheless, nobody can usually see them. But you can, at the moment, see about 100 works from the Ministry of Contemporary, from the Museum of Contemporary Art collection, which are on show at another museum, the Museum of Yugoslav History, which is also where Tito is buried. there's a slight symbolism there, one might say.
Tell me, how much is the government of Belgrade positioning this also as a you know, rather than of course a temple of culture, but also a bit of a tourism draw? Are they putting any numbers? Say this is, you know, hopefully going to, you know, generate a 2 to 5% spike in visitor traffic as well.
I think people are aware that Belgrade could become quite a tourist draw, and they need to do something to work it out. What we've just seen happen is a general election here, which saw the Progressive Party sweep the board, and that included Belgrade City for the first time ever. The Progressives have taken the mayoralty of Belgrade City. So now you've got the government and the mayor of Belgrade being from the same party. You could theoretically see a lot of progress on projects like the Museum of Contemporary Art and the National Museum, which has also been closed for more than a decade, which has a very fine international collection, including the likes of Renoir, Picasso, so on, which, again, nobody's seen for a good 15 years or so now. So if the government and the city of Belgrade are on the same page, which they should be, we could start seeing some progress in these areas.
Tell us about this invisible violence project and what that is all about.
It's extremely intriguing. This is a project which is going on at the sort of little outpost of the Museum of Contemporary Art called the Salon. Now, the Salon is just really a room on one of the main streets opposite the Kalamagdan Fortress Park, but it does tend to put on some interesting exhibitions. And this one is a joint one between Serbian, Northern Irish and Spanish artists, and they're looking at, you know, themes which have existed in these countries, which have often been associated with violence, with terrorism, and expressing those in different ways. And it's taking place in three venues, the Salon, the Spanish Cultural Center, and also the Heritage House in Belgrade. Some interesting things in all sorts of different media, you know, from video making to performance art.
Just before we go, also, you have, there's a museum night. So if anyone's looking to book tickets, weekend after next, is this a new thing? Because obviously we've seen, you know, a number of cities, of course, you know, keeping their cultural institutions open around the clock. I guess the first thing, who leads on it and how sort of widespread and how open house will everything be?
It'll be quite open house. There's some really interesting things going on which aren't normally open. So there's a magic museum in the house of King Peter I, which hasn't been open on normal occasions, which will be open for museum night, which will be going on until 2 o'clock in the morning. So it's a good chance to see some things which are normally kept under lock and key. But for all these people who work in culture in Serbia, and in particular in Belgrade, it's a chance to say, look, there are museums, there are galleries here, which are open, which have interesting things for you to go and see. People who've been starved, perhaps, of cultural outlets because of the closure of the Museum of Contemporary Art and the National Museum have a chance to see something really different and just as nourishing, perhaps.
Guy Delaunay, our man in Belgrade, with a bit of a buffet of all things cultural happening. Thanks very much for that. And that's all the time we have for today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guest, Gavin McFadden, director of the Centre for Investigative Journalism, was here a bit earlier, and John Everard, the UK's former ambassador to North Korea. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Alexandra May and Harriet Baker, and our studio manager was Bill Luty. Next, after the headlines, is Culture with our Robert Bound. Among some of the highlights on this week's program, Rob meets John Ronson. Then at 2200, The Monocle Daily with Ted Kravitz and Emma Nelson is going to be here. And this show will be back at the very same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Tyler Berlay. Have a very good evening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.